Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the so-called money media election complex keeps distorting the democratic process. How did we get here and where are we headed? Then we explore the effects of prison conditions on both the inmates and the guards and the alternatives to the current punishment regime. The 2012 elections cost more than $10 billion, says our next guest, and what amounts to what he calls the money and media election complex, a system that informs fewer and fewer voters about the realities of the candidates or the public policy consequences of the vote. How did we get here and where are we headed? Robert McChesney joins us. He is a professor of communication at the University of Illinois. His books include Digital Disconnect, The Death and Life of American Journalism, and his most recent, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Bob McChesney. It's great to have you back with us.
My pleasure to be here, Maria.
Let's start with today's socioeconomic system. You've equated it to really the days of the robber barons. Where do you see that the most?
We call the current system in the United States a dollarocracy as opposed to democracy. I think the evidence is fairly clear now, and I think few people who live in this country would see it any other way at this point in time. We don't really have one person, one vote, and the rule of the people guiding our country. It's $1, one vote, and the rule of money that guides this country. On virtually every issue that matters, where money is involved, where there's powerful interests and wealthy interests have a stake in it, money rules, money wins. That doesn't mean a specific corporate lobby always wins, because they might be squaring off against another one, and then you've got political battle. But it's always about money. And in fact, Marie, in the last 2 years, there have been two or three major studies done independently by leading political scientists from schools like Berkeley and Yale and Virginia and Princeton that have been published by Princeton University Press that have concluded that if you look at the United States government, the interests, the positions, the values, the opinions of the great bulk of Americans, working class and middle class Americans, have absolutely no influence over core policy. You want to understand the core policies that are made on economics, foreign policy, environmental policy, consumer policy, labor policy. You can basically understand the range of debate by looking at the top 1%, that those with money really control the board of governance. And that's dollarocracy. That means democracy, which is supposed to be the rule of the people, doesn't exist. And we see it really on every area. As I said, there's not any one where it sticks out here and not there. And in our view, why we wrote this book, is that elections are sort of the one Achilles heel in dollarocracy situation. Elections are the one moment that Bill Gates, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, and the head of a hedge fund all have the same amount of power as the person who cleans latrines at Walmart on the graveyard shift. They're equals on that one day when they go into the ballot box. And because of that, powerful interests, ever since democracy came along, you had elections, have been scared to death of democracy, scared to death of elections, and they've tried to do whatever they can to minimize the threat of democracy to their unequal control over the society's resources.
One of the things I liked about your book, this particular one, there are two kind of aspects that came together. One was you had this sort of systems look at the elections and the media and the influence. And the other was the kind of historic aspect, how this all came about from the courts, from the mass media, and all of that together. So I'd like to take a look at all of these. First, from the systemic aspect, you sort of coined a new phrase. You're calling it the money media election complex. How do you see this system?
Well, we've got, in the last election cycle, the 2012 cycle, over $10 billion was spent on the election, on the various campaigns for all the races in the country. This was well over twice what was spent just 4 years earlier. And even factoring in inflation, a good 10 times what was spent just a generation earlier. It's an enormous increase, and it's only going to go up. It's going to continue escalating into the visible future. And what we have as a result of this is a huge industry now. And you have consultants, you have super PACs that are basically shadowy groups that have figured out using loopholes at the revenue service how to hide their donations so the public never knows who gives the money that buys all these ads. And we also have a hugest part, the largest, most important part of the money and media election complex are the media themselves. The news media, the commercial broadcasters, get most of that $10 billion in the form of payment for political advertising. And that makes this lobby, this organization, these few companies that own most of the local TV stations, powerful advocates of the status quo. And the commercial television station-owning companies are to campaign finance reform what the National Rifle Association is to efforts to ban assault weapons. I mean, they are the strong, powerful lobby to keep the money flowing into their pockets so they can keep running these ads and prevent any sort of reform of campaigns. Now, to some extent, the Supreme Court, Citizens United decision, took the whole issue out of the hands of policymakers. It said basically no law can prohibit or limit the ability of corporations and billionaires to spend whatever they want on campaigns. That's their constitutional right now. They've inscribed a brand new right never before recognized in the American Constitution, the right to buy an election. And it is now a sacred right, according to the five members of the U.S. Supreme Court. In our book, too, and this gets to the historical part, I'm glad you picked up on the importance. Our argument is that from the beginning of the United States, there's always been a tension between the property owners who had a lot of property and the great mass of people who had very little or no property or no property of great consequence. And, you know, in a democracy, the few with the much are always fearful of the many with little, that it will threaten them. And for that reason, at the founding of the Republic, John Adams, James Madison were very much opposed to universal adult white male suffrage, let alone letting women or people of color vote. They didn't like the idea of people without property voting. They didn't think they'd be trusted to understand who the proper rulers of society ought to be. And I think that this tension has played out throughout American history. And I think, if I can generalize grossly, you know, we go through periods in which there is those with a great deal of property increase their power, and then we have periods in which the popular forces are in ascension. So if you look at the Jacksonian era, that in the 30s, that was a popular period. Reconstruction, a popular period. The Progressive era, following the Gilded Age, a popular era. The New Deal, following the Roaring 20s, a popular era. And then the last great popular uprising in the United States was the 1960s and early 1970s. And that's the last one, and why that's especially important and why we emphasize that last period in the book is that that was a period in which the corporate community in America really freaked out. They were looking at the landscape of America in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and what they saw was that business was held in very low regard by historical standards by many Americans, and that middle-class kids, who normally were very pro-business and rah-rah free enterprise, were singularly hostile to corporations and big business, and where there was a great deal of sympathy for social democracy, for left-wing policies, for egalitarian ideas. And the result of this, the Chamber of Commerce, corporations, went into a dedicated campaign to sort of take control of the government and put it in the hands of business and make business again the rightful rulers of society. And that was what we chronicle in the book. A key part of that movement, and it operated on many fronts, though, was to make the Supreme Court be more sympathetic to corporate interests. And in that, from the very beginning, a key battle that's been fought was to take any limits off the campaign spending of billionaires and corporations. Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court justice, who we chronicle a great depth in the length in the book, actually wrote a now-famous memo in 1971 for the Chamber of Commerce that was distributed to all the heads, CEOs of the major corporations in America as a confidential memo saying, look, you've got to start spending money on lobbying. You've got to start spending money on candidates. You've got to start spending money to take over the media and to get universities to be more sympathetic. And we've got to take over the courts. We've basically got to make a frontal assault on the people running this country and get people who are sympathetic to business to be in charge. And this is what we chronicle in the book. And a key part of it was getting rid of any limitations on the wealthy to take over elections, because they know that if you can spend as much money as you want, the people with the most money can dominate elections. And that's exactly what they want, because they're scared to death of real democracy.
And as I understand it, it was really aimed at also changing the ideology that was starting to already shift in another direction in the U.S. And that's why the educational institutions and the media were so important.
That's right. They had to basically put the idea in people's head that this is the best of all possible worlds and you should not be interested in politics. They really were obsessed with depoliticizing the society. In a famous document from 1979 by a group called the Trilateral Commission, this is sort of an establishment group, they argued that the great problem in America in the 60s and early 70s was that traditionally apathetic populations, women, people of color, especially African Americans, young people, young workers, were getting uppity. They were making demands on the system, and the system only really worked best when they were apathetic and they let the traditional rulers run the society. You could have a democracy. And democracy didn't work when there was to put it bluntly, too much democracy. And they said, what we've got to do is get the traditionally apathetic parts of the population to become apathetic again, to give up any hope that they could do anything politically, and just to go take care of their personal lives, their private lives, get loaded, just do what they do, but let the rulers run the country without their interference. And so that's a crude way to put it, but that's how they were talking among themselves. That's how they were thinking, and they wouldn't put that in their public relations. And that's what the ideology is. Take care of number one, shop till you drop, but never ever think that we could have a better, more just, a more fair world.
You spoke quite a bit about Lewis Powell, especially his role prior to being on the court, and then you talk a bit about his role on the court, like the Bilotti decision. But then you go on and say that another key architect of the system is really John Roberts, our current Supreme Court Chief Justice. Why John Roberts more than any of the others?
Well, John Roberts is the product of dollarocracy. You know, starting in the 1970s and 80s, the Federalist Society was created, and the mission of the Federalist Society was to make sure that the judges on the courts, that Republicans in particular appointed, but even Democrats, but that the Republicans especially appointed, would be very much committed to preserving the dominance of business and wealthy people in American society and business interests, and downplaying labor and popular politics. Since the 1970s, no Republican appointee to the Supreme Court has gone rogue. You know, it used to be you get guys like Earl Warren or Harry Blackmun who'd be appointed by Republicans who are moderate, middle-of-the-road types, and then they get on the court and they would have the freedom and liberty to think through issues, and it oftentimes surprised people. Or John Paul Stevens, another great Republican appointee, surprised people and become, you know, distinguished jurists and who would be considered quite liberal because they were honest, credible public servants. Well, in the new era, judges are now carefully sort of brought through a right-wing farm system, and you make sure you're getting a pure indoctrinated right-wing ideologue who's in with the program before they get appointed any serious court position. And that's when you get your Scalias, your Alitos, your Clarence Thomases, and now you're Roberts. And Roberts is probably the champion. He's a pure political ideologue. We were surprised, at least I was, the more I studied Roberts, to see what a hack the guy is. When the Citizens United case first came before the Supreme Court, it was being argued on very narrow grounds. It wasn't all about getting rid of any bans on billionaire corporate spending on political campaigns. And both sides were arguing it on narrow grounds that wouldn't have really affected the law dramatically, however it was ruled. And Roberts said, send it back, said, I want you to re-argue this and make it much broader. Because Roberts knew what he wanted. He knew the opinion he wanted to write. He needed a case, though, so he could write his opinion. Roberts was committed to getting rid of any limits on billionaire or corporate spending on elections from the moment he got on the court, if not long before that. In the same vein, the other side of the same coin, where Robert, we knew his opinion even before he ever got a case, was the Voting Rights Act that came before the Supreme Court. Because the other side of the coin of unleashing corporate and billionaire money to buy elections, the other side of the coin is suppressing the vote of people who won't vote for dollarcrats. And this means especially black people, young people, students, immigrants, Latinos. And when the Supreme Court ruled on its Voting Rights Act and voted 5-4 to basically abandon enforcement of the Voting Rights Act in the South, it was known that Roberts would do that all along, because you knew this is mission critical to dollarocracy. So southern states and any state could now easily make it much more difficult for Democratic voters not to vote, which is the whole idea. And he delivered the goods. Those were two cases. I mean, the corruption and the cynicism and the shamelessness of this court, it's difficult to exaggerate. We chronicle in the book how this deeply flawed and absurd their defense in Citizens United was, even at the time, and it immediately blew up their claims about it. Yet we can be certain that Roberts will never revisit and say we made a mistake. That one, as far as he's concerned, I'm sure is locked in for all time, or until what John and I argue needs to be done. There's a constitutional amendment that basically overrides what they've done.
There was an article in the New York Times just after the Supreme Court ended its term about John Roberts in particular. It argued that he was very strategic about how he worked the court members themselves, getting the four liberal members to sign on to some opinions, getting them to kind of come up with something moderate, so that he could later use their consensus against them.
Well, yes. I think he is very strategic. There's certain things that are absolutely mission critical that are non-negotiable. Getting rid of the Voting Rights Act, non-negotiable. Letting billionaires buy elections, non-negotiable. Letting corporations have the same rights as individuals, non-negotiable. But everything else is negotiable. I mean, it's on those corporate and class issues that He's always going to deliver the goods for his benefactors. But otherwise, and there are a lot of cases, you know, the health insurance case he had before, gay rights. You know, there he's willing to talk turkey, and he's willing to do what he has to do so he can get away with the stuff that really matters to him.
Those are the cases, those that you say are non-negotiable, that he then incorporates past consensus opinions from the more liberal justices to justify this. So then there are also, of course, cases that came down. One that you noted was Knox versus SEIU, which also disempowered another foe of corporations, which are the unions.
Crucial to the whole dollarocracy movement since the 70s has been the elimination of unions in the United States. And this is for two reasons. The first one, which is obvious, is that corporations don't like unions because they give workers more wages, they cut into profits in the minds of the CEO, and no business really wants workers having any leverage or control over the workplace. They want to control it themselves, so there's always a battle there. If you don't have unions, then companies can more or less do whatever the heck they want, and that's why companies like Walmart do everything in their power to prevent there being unions. But the other reason, and every bit as important, for why Lewis Powell, the Chamber of Commerce and Corporate America declared war on unions and attempted, with large degree of success, to eliminate them, is their political power. Because unions are the only force in the United States, traditionally, and into the 70s, that could raise sufficient funds to organize people to actually win elections against corporate America when corporate America threw all its money into a race. They were the only force that could actually still defeat them. And so getting rid of private sector unions has been job one. They succeeded at that by the early 80s. And what I mean by that is there's been no new major private sector unions formed since the early 80s. It's virtually impossible to start a private sector union now. The rules have been rigged so badly against workers, even though the polling shows that a majority of non-union workers in private sector jobs would love to have a union. They'd love to have the opportunity, but they just don't get that opportunity. So they've won that battle. It's been a major victory. And now they're turning their sights on the only unions that have survived, the public sector unions, which have been able to survive because state governments have been prohibited from using the corporate union-busting tactics. But now we see in numerous states, including Wisconsin, with Scott Walker, they're finding ways to smash these unions to the best of their ability. And once they get rid of public sector unions, especially the teachers' union, then it's open season for the corporate community to sink their teeth into that public education budget.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Robert McChesney about his new book, Dollarocracy. Think about the other big element in a democracy, which is the voter. When I see all this that you have been laying out, and I think the ultimate onus does fall at the feet of the voter. Given today with so much information out there, although it is kind of a morass, what is it that keeps the voters from learning and from participating in a meaningful way?
I'm actually very sympathetic to the American voter and what they go through. You know, the United States only votes by far at the lowest rate of any major democracy. We have the last election, 52% of the eligible population voted in of the adult population, below any other advanced democracy in the world. The standard rate in most democracies is 65, 70, 75%, rates we have not had in this country since the 19th century among eligible voters. If you actually look closely at our elections, it's amazing that we get 50% in a presidential year. In a non-presidential year, it's 30, 35, and in local races, 20% is the turnout. Absurdly low turnouts. And you say, yeah, what's with these knuckleheads? Why don't they vote? Well, if you actually look at it, they have no news media that covers races, so they're not drawn into races to begin with. There's not oftentimes a lot to vote for. Basically, you're voting for the lesser of two evils. And if you're on the liberal side of the equation, you know, there's plenty to be scared of in the Republicans. But there's really not a whole heck of a lot to be excited about in the Democrats. Every fourth year you can get out off your butt and say, I hate the Republicans, I'll vote for a Democrat, just keep the Republicans out. But except for that, there's not much the Democrats are doing to get you very excited. And then finally, when you add into the measure, you know, there's very few races that you vote for anymore that are competitive. Their gerrymandering has been done to such a large extent that the vast majority of seats that one might vote for on the ballot, congressional or legislative, have been gerrymandered out of competitive status. So, you really don't have a whole heck of a lot to vote for. And that's why I would say it's a great credit to 50% of Americans go out to vote. I think it shows that there's a deep-seated commitment to electoral democracy in this system, when in fact everything in the system is saying to you that it's a joke, it's a farce, and it's sick. You know, I guess that's another way to look at it.
We can extend this also to, say, initiatives and referenda, where you're not even voting for a particular person, but you're going to vote for a policy. And usually those policies are pretty meaningful, and they still generate very inadequately educated types of voting that people are learning from the advertising and not taking the time to learn.
Well, again, I think the system is not really set up. It's not supposed to make people learn. It's not supposed to draw people into public. There's almost no journalism coverage of most of the issues in the belt. So a person is pretty much reduced to being bombarded with television ads, which I think almost without exception are detrimental, they're worthless, they're horrendous, they're garbage. And a rational person tunes those out, I think, at a certain point. Unless they're extraordinarily knowledgeable, they're on the inside, they see what the games are being played and what the manipulation going on is, and they're in with it because they have a stake in the race. They believe strongly in one side or the other, one candidate or the other. But the whole system is set to produce cynicism and ennui and just sort of have people throw their hands in the air, especially when you look at we had over 4 million TV candidate ads or political ads in the year 2012. A majority of those are what are called negative ads. And these are ads that are specifically attack ads on the opponent or the other side of an issue. Many of these ads are paid for by these anonymous third-party groups where you have secret funding that can't be traced. So they can say whatever the heck they want, and it's completely unaccountable. These ads are absolutely cancerous. People hate them, but they're very effective, which is why people do them, which is why so much money is spent on them. In a vacuum where you don't have much of a political culture, you have no journalism to speak of, and this is all you're getting, that's the message that people will remember. And the research is quite clear in this. We document it in the book that, you know, this stuff, as much as people say they hate it outwardly, focus group shows that when people come away from the polls and they say, why did you vote for this candidate, not that one, they recite basically what you hear in negative TV ads.
Well, that said, if we were going to design the perfect media system, how would you go about doing that?
Well, I think the evidence is clear, and it's a bit orthogonal from dollarocracy, but it's certainly relevant, that we have to have the same commitment to building a fourth estate today that the framers of the country had. The framers of the country understood that our whole electoral system was predicated on there being a vibrant press and a news media that drew people into public life. And for that reason, they agreed across the board from Washington and Hamilton to Jefferson and Madison and Franklin and Paine that there are to be heavy subsidies to spawn an independent, large, vibrant newspaper press. And so we had huge postal and printing subsidies, which bankrolled and subsidized this massive press throughout the first 100 years of American history. Basically, postage was all but free, and that was the most important cost after printing to any newspaper was distribution. We had free distribution virtually, which made it possible for lots of newspapers to survive, including virtually the entire abolitionist and suffragist press, which couldn't have survived without the subsidy. And, you know, today we're in a, you know, advertising came along and gave the illusion that journalism could be a commercially solvent enterprise, and it didn't need subsidies. And it actually was a commercially solvent enterprise for the entirety of the 20th century. Owners made a fortune doing newspapers, especially they built the empires and monopolies in city after city. But now with the internet coming along and a variety of other factors, advertising is fleeing journalism. It had provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues in the past, and now it's jumping ship. And as we move to the internet, it's moving to what's called smart advertising, where it no longer even supports media or content producers. It simply goes to whatever website it needs to go to find you, and it just goes by the target audience, not the website or the content provider. And in this new world order, there's absolutely no money for journalism. That's why journalism is shriveling. It's shrinking. It's disintegrating. It's disappearing under commercial auspices. And I think that requires a public policy response. We have to have a massive increase in spending on public and community media. We have to set up independent, uncensored, vibrant institutions, have a pluralistic system. But we have to have a major commitment to journalism and covering our communities. Otherwise, our constitutional system fails.
There's one thing we didn't get to. That has to do with, in this new information age, how personal data has played into what you call dollarocracy.
We did a lot of research on how the internet was being brought into the campaign system in 2012. And, you know, the vision of the internet, and I think the assumption that people make about it routinely, is that it's sort of this big, lovely jungle filled with awesome stuff that fills up, and it's just there if you had the time and the brains and the willingness and gumption and diligence to go get it. It's all out there, and you can get the truth about anything. And that's a very comforting vision, but it has nothing to do with how the internet has evolved under commercial auspices. Today, the internet is run by a handful of enormous monopolies that rank among the 10 or 20 largest companies in the United States, if not the world. Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. I mean, these are all just giant companies. And they've changed the whole logic of the internet to, instead of like you're anonymous on it, you can go anywhere and get the truth because you can see what everyone else sees, instead, you're completely unanonymous. Everything we do online is tracked by these companies. They know everything about us. That's what the NSA scandal showed. And they not only know and track everything about us, then they use that information to sell us stuff through this whole smart advertising. It's based on total surveillance. And then every one of us now gets different ads based on who we are, even looking at the same website. And we get different content on websites. We get different answers to searches, depending on who we are, because they know our history, the companies that we use online and advertisers. And what the Obama campaign did for the first time is they applied this new world internet to the political campaign, and they bought a huge amount of cloud space from the Amazon cloud service. And they put all their data on Americans. They have files on every American voter and non-voters. Lots of information on all of us. And they learned how to direct specific messages to each of us, different messages talking about different issues, emphasizing different sales techniques based on what they know about us from everything we do on Facebook and everything we do online, all the information they've gathered. And it was spectacularly effective. I think that the people on the inside would tell you if there's anything that accounts for why Obama won the election, that was probably it, because they were so far ahead of everyone else. They were so far ahead of even Silicon Valley that after the election, Silicon Valley was going to the Obama headquarters in Chicago, where they had hundreds of these computer whizzes working, and were hiring those guys because they'd done such an extraordinary job of surveilling the American voters and getting out the vote and raising money from their people.
The book, again, is called Dollarocracy, and we're speaking with Robert McChesney, who is one of the co-authors of the book. Thank you so much, Bob McChesney.
My great pleasure, Maria. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, the impact of prison conditions on inmates, the guards, and society itself. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Scholars and international experts have argued that solitary confinement amounts to torture and should be banned as a means of punishment. Still, in the U.S., hundreds are subjected to the treatment for more than 10 years, according to Amnesty International. What are the impacts of harsh prison conditions, both on inmates and on the guards? What are the alternatives to the current punishment regime? Three experts join us. Hope Metcalf is the Associate Research Scholar in Law and Director of the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Program. She teaches a clinic on prisoners' rights in the United States and is co-author of the reports Administrative Segregation, Degrees of Isolation and Incarceration, A National Overview of State, and Federal Correctional Policies, and Gideon at Guantanamo, Democratic and Despotic Detention. Philip Zimbardo is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University and currently on the core faculty of Palo Alto University. He has authored more than 50 books, including The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, Psychology in Life, and The Psychology of Attitude Change and Social Influence. Stuart Grassian also joins us. He is a psychiatrist and a former faculty member at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of Psychiatric Effects of Solitary Confinement and The Effects of Sensory Deprivation in Psychiatric Seclusion and Solitary Confinement. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Philip Zimbardo, I'd like to start with you. There's a piece that you have written where you summarize what you have found in the Stanford prison experiments and the work that you've done around this. And you've said prisons are places that demean humanity, destroy the nobility of human nature, and bring out the worst in social relations among people. You go on to talk about how they're just as bad for the guards as they are for the prisoners and for society, and that there's really nothing worse. What is it that has led you to conclude that they are this bad?
I'm not really an expert on prisons. I created a mock prison at Stanford back in 1971. But even in that little setting, it was clear that in this mock prison, the essentials of prisons are about power, where guards constantly have to affirm that they have total power and prisoners have none. And they do this by creating an arbitrary, hostile, brutal environment that the prisoners have to adapt to or break down. And that's what we saw in our study, that normal, healthy college students, within a matter of days, were having emotional breakdowns because of the brutality of the guards. And our system was modeled after American prison systems. It was nowhere near as extreme as real prisons. I visited San Quentin's Maximum Adjustment Center some years ago as part of a lawsuit contending that maximum adjustment, which is a euphemism for solitary confinement, was cruel and unusual punishment. And at that time, Federal Judge Zerpley approved, saying that it is amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. It has to be changed. But the changes they put in place were cosmetic, and they've gotten much worse since then. I've met with people who have come out of literally months of solitary confinement. I've met with people who've come out of years of being incarcerated. The young man who was my consultant in the prison study, Carlo Prescott, brilliant young man, was clear that he was permanently ruined by his experience. He came out filled with rage, filled with anger that could never be fully expressed. The other thing is prisons teach people how to be criminals. We know that 60 to 70% of all prisoners are recidivists, meaning within 3 years they go back. And what I discovered, looking at the statistics, in a quarter of the cases, the crime they go back for a second time, a third time, is significantly worse, significantly more serious than the first one. So they are learning not how to be rehabilitated, not learning how to readjust to society. They are learning how to be hardened criminals. So the last thing I want to point out is that the National Academy of Sciences have recently created a work group on over-incarceration in the United States, trying to understand why more than 2 million Americans are in the prison system, more than or maybe twice as much as any country in the world. And, of course, in Michelle Alexander's book, New Jim Crow, she talks about mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness. That is, a disproportional number of the people who are in prison are black, minorities, Hispanic. And in that sense, have really destroyed many black communities. Most of African Americans in prison are there for drug-related charges. So the situation is terrible. And the last thing I want to mention is, because prisons are a multi-billion-dollar industry, the budgets in many states are higher than the budget for university education, but each state says they're broke. So now we are privatizing prisons. We're turning them over to private for-profit agencies. And if it's for-profit, they could care less about rehabilitation. In fact, any expenses that are drain on profits will go out the window, like exercise, like rehabilitation programs, and so forth, even like classes. So for me, the situation in 1971 was terrible, and now it's significantly worse. For me, it's very personally depressing.
Before we move on and talk more specifically about some of these conditions, I just wanted to revisit your primary finding about your simulated prison at the Stanford Prison Experiment, which was that perfectly healthy people became their roles. Can you just briefly talk about that phenomenon? maybe it'll help people to better understand things that happen in real prisons. Yours, I think, lasted 6 days.
Right. Yeah. The study I conducted, it's presented in full depth for 10 chapters worth in my book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Go Bad, Do Bad. In our study, we created a mock prison in which we had 24 normal, healthy, young college students from around the country that we had given personality tests, clinical interviews, and we picked only those who were most normal, healthy. So these are the best and brightest of students in 1971. And these, again, are at 71, these are anti-war activists. These are civil rights activists. These are hippie kids. And we randomly assign them to prisoners and guards. So there's no reason why somebody should be a prisoner, somebody should be a guard. And they all knew that. They knew it was an experiment. Within a day and a half, it stopped being an experiment in their mind. It became a psychological prison run by psychologists. And no one ever used the word experiment. If they wanted to get out, they don't say, I quit the experiment. They say, I want to be paroled, and we would have a parole board. But what happened very quickly, within 36 hours, people became their role. You put on the uniform of a guard and the symbols of power, the billy club, the whistle, the handcuffs, the silver reflecting sunglasses, and you become a guard when you step out on the yard. You're forced to wear the demeaning uniform of a prisoner. In our case, we also had a chain on their foot to remind them, even when they were sleeping, that they were imprisoned. And you become a prisoner. Prisoners rebelled, as they always do, but they got crushed in the end. Within 36 hours, the first prisoner had an emotional breakdown, had to be released, and he became a model of how you get out of this nightmare that they thought was going to be kind of fun and games, playing like cops and robbers. And each day thereafter, for the next 5 days, another prisoner had an emotional breakdown. So we ended the study after 6 days, although we had originally intended for it to last for 2 weeks. And I'm sorry that it went even that long.
Stuart Grassian, let's bring you in. You've looked considerably at solitary confinement, both the history and the effects of it. Now, it was created for a specific reason, but then evolved into something else. What do we need to understand about how solitary confinement developed and its effects?
Well, its history is really very fascinating because the United States was actually the leading country in bringing solitary confinement to the fore back in the very early part of the 19th century. And ironically, it was introduced by the Quakers initially. It was thought that if you could take people away from the evils of modern society and the city life and bring them in touch with themselves, with God, with work, and their own true natures, they would naturally heal. So the idea was get them away from everyone else who was an evil influence, and that meant solitary confinement. And that institution was, we were very proud of it back then, and it was widely studied, emulated. All the great visitors from Europe came and looked at the penitentiaries. Many brought them back for emulation, and lo and behold, it was an absolute disaster. People were becoming psychotic, people were dying, people were suiciding, and of course, eventually it fell into disfavor, so much so that there's a striking case. In 1890, the United States Supreme Court looked at a case involving a man who had murdered his wife and was duly tried and convicted and sentenced to death on the gallows. But the law had changed so that under the new law, he would first be housed in solitary confinement for somewhere around 1 month, and then he would be hung, as opposed to staying in the county jail. This was now the new Colorado State Penitentiary. Well, his lawyers argued that this additional punishment of 1 month of solitary confinement was so egregious that you couldn't possibly sentence them under this new law. And they also pointed out that the old law was rescinded at the time of the passing of the new and had the nerve to say, well, then you have to release him. Well, the Supreme Court looked at this. They recognized and acknowledged that solitary confinement causes severe psychiatric harm, insanity, suicide, and that those who survived the ordeal better were not generally reformed and often incapable of readjusting to the larger community and being, as they said, of any subsequent service to the community. The United States Supreme Court in 1890 ordered that this man be released. The order was to the warden of the Colorado State Penitentiary, ordering that he escort Mr. Medley to the gates and let him go free. Mr. Medley got away with murder as a result of this change that would add 30 days about of solitary confinement to a sentence of death on the gallows. And as I always point out, at this point, we have come a long way downhill from there. This idea that solitary confinement is not toxic to mental functioning has no basis in reality, no basis in any medical literature, and there's a lot of medical literature in the other direction. In fact, the issue of the effects of solitary confinement has been of major concern to the United States. Folks remember their history. The Korean War led to concerns about brainwashing of American prisoners of war and a concern about the KGB using these kind of techniques to brainwash people. Well, as a result, there was actually an enormous body of research that was done about the effects of solitary confinement. And lo and behold, this research was funded by the U.S. CIA and the Canadian Department of Defense. It was about 19 years of research on it at Harvard and McGill universities. So I just want to close with saying we know that solitary confinement is toxic to mental functioning. There is really no question about that. And yet that fact is systematically ignored by folks who want to continue to use that practice.
Hope Metcalf, let's bring you in, too. You have looked at the more modern practice of it throughout the states and the federal government. What have your findings been?
Well, before I get to that, I just want to pick up on one thing that Dr. Grassian was saying to really echo that. The present incarnation of solitary confinement as we see it in many prisons across the U.S. not only echoes what former American enemies have done against U.S. soldiers, but also reflects what we saw with many of the Bush policies post 9/11. And in fact, the way I came to this subject was because I was working on one case in particular on behalf of Jose Padilla. Some folks might remember he was a U.S. citizen held in military custody where he was tortured and interrogated. And one of the things that he complained about the most was the just crushing isolation that he experienced while he was in military custody. Well, he eventually was released to the criminal justice system where he was tried, convicted, and is now in nearly identical conditions, not undergoing interrogation anymore, but still under the same crushing isolation at a federal penitentiary called Florence ADX in Colorado. The express purpose of the U.S. policies there in the counterterrorism context were to dehumanize and to render the subject utterly helpless. It was called learned helplessness, was in fact the phrase used by those who constructed this interrogation method. So when we think about how this policy plays out over the many states and in the many, many prisons and jails where it's used, I think that that's a useful and relevant backdrop. So we recently completed a survey of the policies regarding the use of administrative segregation, which is a form of separation of prisoners who have been sentenced. And there are basically several different types of segregation used in the prison system. Some are called punitive or disciplinary, others are called protective, and some are called administrative. We focused on administrative because that is the broadest category, and typically people are sent to administrative segregation for indefinite terms. And so this is often where you see people languishing for years, if not decades. So we did a study of 47 states and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. We spent a lot of time just poring over the policies to see what we might find out. The clear trend that we saw was that they all sort of relied on a very broad purpose. So the criteria for why you could be placed were extremely broad. Generally, there was language regarding the safety of staff and inmates and or the order of the institution. I want to pause here to say that there is no doubt that horribly violent things happen in prisons all the time. And so I think if we're to talk about the use of isolation in prison, we need to really be mindful of the very real challenges that both prisoners, staff, and administrators face, and the sort of how the violence is created, how it reproduces itself, I think are things that perhaps we can get into later in the conversation, and whether isolation is in fact a useful intervention is an altogether different issue. But there's no question that safety is an issue in prison, and safety is in fact what at least on paper drives the use of isolation. Now, the difference and the line between safety and control is a whole other question and something we might get back to later, because I think from looking at policy after policy, we just were really struck at how broad they were and how an inmate would really have no basis to understand what would land them in indefinite isolation. And then the other general trend that we saw that was just, as one would expect, where there's broad criteria, there's just incredible discretion and a lack of predictability about who's going to end up in administrative segregation and why. And this has been borne out in states that have chosen to look at closely at their own populations in long-term segregation. Every state that has undertaken that task has ultimately decided to reduce their populations in long-term segregation by at least 50%, often 90%. And the reason is because oftentimes when you look at it in practice, people are being sent to segregation not because they're truly dangerous, but because perhaps they're troublemakers or the prison doesn't know what else to do with them. In terms of our other findings, we found that really the procedures varied greatly. You know, a lawyerly response to the issue of segregation might be to say, well, one should add more process, be sure that the right people are looking, you know, conducting robust reviews. Our sense is that the jurisdictions varied widely. My hunch is that additional procedures could make some difference, but unless we wrestle with the much more basic question of when and why should this practice ever be allowed, all the procedures in the world aren't going to do much good. There was also a great deal of variation about what happens to people once they get into long-term segregation. Some jurisdictions, such as Washington, are now making an effort, I think a genuine effort, to try to think of what types of programming will assist those who do have severe behavioral or other issues and who have proven to be violent continually when they're in general population or less secure settings. I'm no mental health expert, so there's certainly questions to be considered about when and if mental health treatment can really be appropriately provided in that type of extremely controlled setting. I guess I'll leave it there, except to note that, you know, we just looked at the policies, and the policies and the practice, of course, can be widely divergent. And so what we don't know is far more striking than what we do know. We don't know who is in segregation. We don't know the demographics. We don't know why they're there. We don't know how long they're there. And let alone we don't know, even to the extent that segregation is being used modestly by a particular jurisdiction for perceived safety issues, we have no idea whether or not it works. And there's lots of reasons to think, in fact, that it might aggravate people who have violent tendencies. And so I hope that we are at the cusp of the use of segregation being, if not completely obliterated, then certainly decreased significantly.
If I could just add to that, actually, in those states where there has been a significant reduction in solitary confinement, the use of solitary confinement, there's very often concern that are raised by the Department of Corrections that doing so is going to increase the violence, is going to increase the danger to the prison staff. And the findings are strikingly the opposite, that there is no increase in violence, and often there is actually a decrease in the violence that you see in those prisons. Because these types of settings, this whole procedure with solitary confinement, first of all, the people who become subject to it are so typically people who have mental health problems. And that's a real strong basis for why they're doing what they're doing. But if you take the state of Maine, where Joe Ponte, who's the commissioner, really took a very brave step of severely reducing the use of solitary confinement. It's now, I think, about 25% of what it was before. There has been no increase in violence, and in fact, there is some evidence of decrease in violence as a result.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the effects of prisons and prison conditions. Philip Zimbardo, to bring you back in.
Yeah, I just wanted to say two things. One, of course, is that many of the people in solitary confinement are there, in quote, because they're seen as troublemakers from the point of view of the guards or systems. The other population of people in the solitary are informers, snitches, who were put there for their protection. And in fact, I was involved in the San Quentin Six murder case, following up with George Jackson. And the first thing the prisoners did when solitary confinement was, when it was open, when George Jackson came down with the keys, is they killed, they massacred the informants. So again, as I said, security is an issue. But everything we know about the importance of social contact, of social connection, says that anything that isolates us from other people in the human condition is detrimental to mental health. And the longer people are isolated, the more devastating it becomes, and the harder it is for them ever to really adjust. Certainly, harder it is to ever adjust to being back in main society.
With these lessons, can we start to think about an alternative system that actually brings out more positive social behavior? Philip Zimbardo, you're the person who has really kind of taken the lead on how the system makes the person. How do you see a potential system for real rehabilitation?
One simple refocusing is, suppose when prisoners are given a jail term, when prisoners exhibit good behavior, that the guards get credit for it. And the shorter the time a prisoner spends in prison, the guards get rewarded, get salary bonuses. So you change now the incentive of the guards to be supportive, to be helpful, to be informative to prisoners, rather than to be indifferent or dehumanize them. There's no incentive for guards to treat a prisoner well. There's every incentive to get them out of their face, put them in solitary confinement indefinitely. Our maximum security prisons, as in Pelican Bay, have prisoners in there for 23 hours a day and for months and months, maybe even longer. And they mimic what's happened at Guantanamo Bay. Only these are not terrorists. These are not people who threaten the well-being of America. These are people who've broken a law at some point, were sent by jury to prison, but not to the nightmare that is there. So we need to say one way to change the prison is we have to really think in terms of systemic changes, not cosmetic changes, a little program in this prison or that. How do we make it so that the guards actively work to help prisoners get out of prison, rather than keep them in prison as long as possible, because that's their breadbasket.
Stuart Grassian?
Yes. You know, I'm just reminded of cases I've been involved in. There's one in particular that stands out in my mind. The settlement of the class action lawsuit required that the prison recognize that a lot of the behaviors that were causing the inmates to end up in solitary confinement were, in fact, manifestations of mental illness. And that's very typical, by the way. I mean, that's not unusual that that would be the case. The net result was so good. I mean, it was so beneficial to all concerned, the corrections officers and, of course, the inmates as well, that, and this is the irony of it, that one of the named defendants, the head of OMH, tried to take credit for the changes. But he was a named defendant. It was under his watch that this was happening. Yet the result was so obviously good for all concerned. And I think that one needs to really empower mental health concepts in dealing with people in prison, much more than is being done, much, much more. In fact, I was thinking, you know, in a psychiatric hospital, we always run case conferences, and those include all the staff. They include the non-really clinically trained staff. Well, why? It's because you have to give people a richer way of looking at behavior, because otherwise they feel helpless and they become angry. But if you give them a richer context, a richer way of thinking about it, it helps a lot. And people start really changing their behavior towards the inmate.
Hope Metcalf, what would you add in terms of the policy?
I would add something a little bit on the political end, and then let me see if I can get to the policy end. So the folks who lead these corrections departments, many of them actually, I think, would be allies. They are strapped for resources. They had probably the politically least popular departments in state government. They face enormous challenges. They are going to be the first to be fired should someone be released and something terrible happen. And there are actually people who are trying to make change from the inside, but they need a political constituency. They need people demanding that from the state legislators or governors who are going to be quick to turn a fast political buck by you know, calling for more retributive policies. So I think identifying and lifting up the more progressive corrections leaders, whether it's the folks at the top or those in the middle, is a key aspect of long-term change here, as opposed to perhaps more divisive politics where we sort of, you know, make each other on each side into cartoons. And on the policy side, I completely agree with everything that's been said thus far. I think mental health is a key part of it. I also think the culture is essential, and it comes down to a fairly simple question, I think, that a leader of one of a corrections department said to me, which was, she said, you know, really at the end of the day, the question is, are we afraid of this person? Or are we just mad at them? Because if we're afraid of them, then we should be dealing with them in a particular way that's going to implicate security, to treat them safely, to figure out what works, to be creative, to integrate mental health approaches, et cetera. But if we're just mad at them and sort of putting them in the troublemaker category, then this is a really counterproductive policy.
Thank you, Stuart Grassian, Hope Metcalf, Philip Zimbardo. Really appreciate your work. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Hope Metcalf is the Associate Research Scholar in Law and Director of the Arthur Lyman Public Interest Program. She teaches a clinic on prisoners' rights in the United States and is co-author of the reports Administrative Segregation, Degrees of Isolation and Incarceration, A National Overview of State and Federal Correctional Policies, and Gideon at Guantanamo, Democratic and Despotic Detention. Philip Zimbardo is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University and currently on the core faculty of Palo Alto University. He has authored more than 50 books, including The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, and The Psychology of Attitude Change and Social Influence. Stuart Grassian is a psychiatrist and a former faculty member at Harvard Medical School. He is the author of Psychiatric Effects of Solitary Confinement and The Effects of Sensory Deprivation in Psychiatric Seclusion and Solitary Confinement. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Melissa Chiprin and Ankine Agassian. And most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can always podcast us. Follow us at thescholarcircle.org and at Armudian on Twitter.